Welcome to She's On Call. We're a weekly video talk show devoted to medical topics. I'm Dr. Sujana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon with offices in Midtown Manhattan and Wayne, New Jersey.
I'm Marina Curry, and I'm a general surgeon and a minimally invasive surgeon that also does weight loss surgery and weight loss management in New York City. And we also, being live every week, we also take viewer questions for our fantastic guests. Today's show, we have two wonderful experts, and our show is actually going to be focusing on COVID. And first guest is Anne Ambrose. Dr. Ambrose is a director of research and rehabilitation medicine at Montefiore Medical Center, just up the street. And Dr. Elizabeth Parfitt is a senior infectious disease physician at the Royal Inland Hospital in Kamloops, which is in British Columbia, Canada. We're going to talk to them in just a couple of minutes. But first,
well, we are live on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitter, and on LinkedIn, and on scroll.in. And on Mondays, we are aired on WBAI FM from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern time. So if you're watching us live, please check in with us. Let us know where you're watching from and send in some questions for our experts. Before we get to COVID, Marina, rare show that we're going to start not talking about COVID.
I was going to say the same thing. For once, we're not going to start off talking about COVID because we're going to talk about it the rest of the time.
Exactly.
Too much. And of course, Sujana always finds some news that has something to do with her ear specialty. She's an ear surgeon after all. So she found, and this is awesome, that Lou Ferrigno, the original Incredible Hulk, you guys all remember the show, I'm sure, he got a cochlear implant. And there's a video where you can go and watch, but just talk a little bit about cochlear implants, Sujana.
So cochlear implants are done, and you know, Marina, we had a whole show on hearing, and we had Dr. Charles Lim and Dr. Shelley Chada on that show. But cochlear implants are done, an electrode is placed inside the inner ear, the thing that looks like a snail, and connected to a receiver stimulator so that we replace the non-functioning inner ear. And it's an amazing, amazing technology. And what used to be only to help you kind of alert to where sounds are coming from really now gives you what's called open set speech discrimination, which is the ability to understand what people are saying without a script of what they'll be saying and in somewhat challenging listening environments. Most of our cochlear implant patients can use the telephone. Most of them do exceptionally well. And Mr. Ferrigno apparently lost his hearing bit by bit, and the video of his reaction to hearing with an implant for the first time is really heartwarming. We've all seen the baby hears for the first time videos, but an adult hearing again for the first time in a long time is quite remarkable. And Marina, I did not tell you this, but I am like a degree of separation away from two Incredible Hulks, because Mr. Ferrigno's operation was done at the House Ear Institute, where I was a fellow a million years ago. And the current Incredible Hulk had his skull-based surgery also at the House Ear Institute, where I was a fellow a million years ago. So I am two hulks away.
I feel like that's like a real stretch of a connection, but okay, I'm going to let you have this. It's so
that's the closest I'll ever get to Mark Ruffalo, okay? So there you go.
So the cochlear implant, because I have a patient who has them, and she has both, but she prefer, and with the mask, when I've seen her, it's been a little harder. But she likes me to speak to her directionally. Like if I'm talking and I turn, she's like, "Doc, look at me and talk to me." So I know that the sound has to come in a certain way. And obviously before, I know that she would watch my, I talk fast. So I think she watches my lip a little bit. So it's not exactly the same way of hearing, right?
Right. It's not. And there's a learning curve, and the learning curve never ends. So in the beginning, it's really enhanced speech reading, as you're talking about. But over time, you can actually have without visual cues, and they do very well. And frankly, between masks and noise. It's been very hard for people with hearing loss to hear. The cochlear implant really cuts through a lot of that.
I mean, I don't know if you guys were on Twitter, all of you watching, but Siju and I got together, and thankfully the photo's not here, but it is on Twitter. And we finally got to see each other in person. And it's because I had an ear emergency. I couldn't hear and I needed to, or it was just blunted and I kept feeling like I couldn't pop my eardrum. We don't have to get into what we found. But what I was really thinking when you were like, and now people who gradually lost their hearing, Suju also takes care of my parents because, you know, I only trust the best. And so she sees them. Maybe they need cochlear implants because their hearing's a lot off, my dear.
You know, my mom just wrote in and said, I need a cochlear implant. and the reality is we can safely do cochlear implants in as young as 7 or 8 or 9 months old and as old as 90 plus. It's a really safe operation. It's definitely, if you are struggling with your hearing aids and really not able to use them the way you should talk to your otolaryngologist about consideration for a cochlear implant.
In other health news, we are going to talk a little bit about a new drug for lung cancer, for treating a specific type of lung cancer. Lung cancer is the leading cancer killer in the U.S., and it accounts for about 25% of all cancer deaths. And non-small cell cancer makes up 80% of the cases. Now, is non-small cell, such as the one that younger women, like in their 40s, are getting? I believe it's that one.
Yeah, I think so. They're the one that it's affecting larger percentage of people and younger people.
Yeah, and it's not always smoking related, but it may be, as in primary smoking or the person smoking, can be secondhand smoke related as well.
Right. And there is a trial that just completed of an immune modulating agent that the name of which is very hard to say. So it's called alizolizumab. I practiced this so many times yesterday. Alizolizumab. And it's already been shown to be effective in late stage cancer, but it is doubling the effectiveness of current chemotherapies in stage 2 to 3A cancer. Unfortunately, because it blocks a significant immune response, it also has a lot of side effects. So if you have lung cancer, it potentially is a treatment for you. The best way to prevent lung cancer is to stop smoking and to cut out your exposure to secondhand smoke and arsenic in your water and radon. The guidance is from age 55 or on, if you are a heavy smoker, you should get a chest CAT scan every year. And if you quit smoking, but you were a heavy smoker less than 15 years ago, you also need a yearly chest CAT scan. And the reason is we want to catch these cancers early so that we have the best chance of curing them.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a big shift. A lot of times, like when you go for screening colonoscopy and screening endoscopy, if you're high risk, these things are done like every 2 to 3 years. But what they're saying now, and this is the ATA, the American Thoracic Association, and is that you're going to do this every year, which is a big shift. It's almost the same as, you know, mammogram prevention. That is also every year. But for smoking, getting that chest CT, it's important to do if you have that history or if you are an active smoker, and get that chest CT every year.
Yeah. And I think the other thing to say is 15 years. So frankly, if you're a heavy smoker now, stop smoking. And there are ways to help you stop smoking, because you really reduce your risk back to non-smoking levels after 15 years, even if you're a heavy smoker for many, many years. So it is still worth it to take the effort to stop smoking, and your doctor can definitely help you with that.
We're going to bring our guests on now. Again, we want to remind you, and if you're watching, please tweet, share, like, so that your friends can also watch the show. But our guests are Dr. Ambrose, and she's the director of research and rehabilitation medicine at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx, and Dr. Elizabeth Parfit, Liz Parfitt's a senior infectious disease physician at the Royal Inland Hospital in Kamloops, British Columbia in Canada. Welcome to our guests.
Welcome. We're very happy to see you. We have Jayshree Sundaram watching from Ottawa. So we have the Canadians tuning in. We have Ellen Austin watching from New York City. We have Deirdre Gruen watching from Glen Ridge, New Jersey. Nancy Ross watching from New York City. Neil Parekh watching from Springfield, Virginia. You know, COVID, 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 like Marsha, 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 right, on the Brady Show. But frankly, it's been over a year, and there is so much we have learned, so much we still have to learn. And we are so grateful to the two of you for coming on board with us to talk to us. But before we get to COVID, there is another very cool story that came out of the University of Pittsburgh. And Anne, this is really in your bailiwick as a rehab medicine doctor. There is a robot, a person who was implanted with electrodes in their brain, both in their motor cortex, the part of their brain that moves things, and in their sensory cortex, the part of the brain that feels things, so they could move their robotic arm twice as fast as they could before they could feel what was going on. And this is somebody who had an accident and was paralyzed and could not move either arm. Can you explain what this, how amazing this is?
Well, this is very revolutionary in the whole world of robotics. Even if you think about it, the robotic arm, even if you had just the motor cortex, that is quite amazing. This is thought controlled. We don't know the exact mechanism of how this occurs, but the patients who've been trained can actually, just using their thoughts, are able to activate this limb at all the multiple joints. But they had no sensation, so they could only do this by controlling it by vision. They had to look at the object, remember from their past experiences how heavy it is, how it feels, how big it is, and then they're able to, by using their vision, they are able to control the grip. Now, with this tactile interface, this is changing. This is a game changer. The person can, the limb can actually feel the object, and this is now cutting down the processing time. This is very new, and most of us don't know all the details, but it is so exciting. This is opening up a new world of robotic rehabilitation.
Thank you so much for that. And it is. I was, when you said it's thought control, I was like, Magneto.
It's happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool, and it is wonderful to see, because it gives hope to so many people who, unfortunately, through accidents, whatever, have had paralysis, and it really is an amazing thing. We are going to talk about COVID, though. We know we have some new numbers, and you know, we were talking earlier amongst ourselves about how there are 166 million cases of COVID worldwide, and there have been, we say, 3.4 million deaths worldwide as well. But we do believe that some of it is underreporting, undercounting, right? From earlier in the course of COVID, you know, there was underreporting from China as well as Russia. But now in India, I think it's just a matter of, not that they're trying to actively undercount, but it's hard to really fathom how many people are suffering and dying from COVID there right now.
You know, in Nepal, the positivity rate for testing is 50%. So one out of two people tested is COVID positive. So we are seeing huge hotspots around the world. We, you know, started this pandemic a little over a year ago, talking about masks and social distancing and washing your hands and not touching your eyes. And all of that still holds true. Isn't that correct, Liz?
Absolutely. Yeah, so we still need to be focusing on all of our layers of protection, which includes, of course, vaccination as the strongest layer, but also wearing a mask when we're indoors and in closed spaces, and focusing on things also like ventilation has also received more attention in the last few months, and many people have been advocating for more attention on that as well throughout the pandemic. And all the regulars, the hand hygiene, reducing contacts, the basics still work, and the vaccination is like the superstar on scene.
It really is. You know, it's funny. I've always been a germaphobe. I always hated touching elevator buttons and, you know, door handles and things like that. Forget the bathroom. I'm like, paper, and then I have to open the door, put the heel in, you know, so it's, to me, I'm glad everybody else is joining the club, because otherwise people are like, what are you doing? I'm like, yeah, I can't touch everything. And so I think that it is, you know, hand washing and being cognizant of not touching surfaces, you know, the subway pole. Suja and I took the subway to school. We went to high school, not at the same time, but at the same high school. And so you take the subway and, you know, it'd be so packed, people trying to squeeze in, and then everyone's sneezing, coughing, touching the pole, you know, the pole to hold on so you don't fall over.
Right. You can hold the pole with like the tips of a thumb and a finger just to make sure you don't fall over.
Yeah, but it's a big change, and I think it's a good thing. And as you said, the shining star really is the vaccinations that are coming up. And filtration is another, and we had a little outbreak in our building because our guys were, you know, their break room did not have a filter, a filtration process, and it was a closed room. There was no window to open. So we've subsequently brought something in that will help. And I know that many of the schools around the country have also done something like that. Liz, are they?
Sandra Blake Lefkowitz just wrote in, she feels the same way. Marina, you and she are trendsetters.
Yes.
Trendsetters. Yeah. So, you know, vaccines were developed so quickly, and this is a question I get from my patients every day. They were approved in the US by December for a disease we didn't even know existed before February last year. So in the US, we have three vaccines that are approved: Pfizer, Moderna, and the single shot J&J. And of these, the Pfizer is now emergency use authorization for age 12 and above, and the other two are for 18. In Canada, you guys have Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and AstraZeneca approved. And again, over the age of 12 for Pfizer, but recommended for age 30 and above for the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson. And I wonder if you can explain to us, because I think in Canada, Liz, the rollout has not been as quick as in the United States. And I wonder if you can explain to us how people get vaccines there, and are you still vaccinating more vulnerable groups first, because in the US it's open to everybody in those age groups?
Yeah, great question. So in Canada, the way that we are vaccinating happens different in each province. So in British Columbia, we have a slightly different system than Alberta, and the rollout has depended on what province you live in. And of course, we were at the mercy of suppliers because we were not manufacturing any vaccines here in Canada, but hopefully that will change. So we have been slower, but in my community, which is about 100,000 people in South Central British Columbia, I was just looking at the data last night, we now have 80% of our population aged 50 plus who have received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine. And of the 18 plus population, we're actually at 60%. So I believe that we've actually crossed the threshold and kind of caught up to the US. Although having said that, with a bit of a slightly different strategy, well, not slightly different, but a different strategy where we've been early adopters of the delayed second dose strategy, which is turning out to look like a pretty good strategy, actually, despite early criticisms. I just wanted to mention, with regards to the AstraZeneca vaccine, again, depending on the province you live in, the recommendations have changed, and some provinces have decided to stop offering it, but might offer it for a a second dose later, just because of the concerns around the VITT syndrome, which is, of course, very rare. But if we can access mRNA vaccines, which are not associated with that syndrome, we're sort of preferring that strategy. It all depends on probabilities. If you're in a really hot spot and you're aged 50, then AstraZeneca is probably still a very good choice. But if you are in a very low incidence area and you're 25 years old and you can wait to get an mRNA vaccine, that's sort of been the messaging we've had from our national vaccine advisory body.
Liz, two questions. One, just what is the syndrome you're referring to? And then the second question, we're going to show a slide on vaccine efficacy, if you can just run through that. But first, what is that syndrome?
Absolutely. So VITT is vaccine-induced thrombocytopenia with thrombosis. So what this is it's a very rare syndrome. Of course, we're still learning exactly where the numbers are, but I'm seeing estimates around 1 in 50,000 people to 1 in 100,000 people. That may change as we get more data. But what that means is that the vaccine is causing this rare interaction where platelets clump together and cause clots. And of course, we want to have vaccines that are, basically close to 100% safe. So this is a little bit of a disappointment. But again, it's extremely rare, and the vaccine is still incredibly effective at reducing hospitalization, reducing symptomatic illness, reducing death from COVID-19. So it's important that people know about that syndrome so that if they have received the vaccine with AstraZeneca, that they can present for care if they develop symptoms of blood clot. The blood clots can be in different body parts. So we talk about, headaches that are unusual, abdominal pain that's unusual, swelling in the limbs.
Liz, this is also what happened with Johnson & Johnson?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. So if you've talked about that before, it's
We like it. I mean, headaches are because it saw that rare form of cavernous sinus thrombosis. So I just didn't realize that there was a syndrome name to it. Thank you for enlightening me. The second question I had was we wanted to discuss something about vaccine efficacy. And we have a slide. There we go. That looks at the different vaccines and their efficacy against COVID-related disease. If you want to just comment on that, because
absolutely. So maybe I'll start with just a quick explanation. So efficacy is what we talk about in clinical trials, and then once the vaccine gets out into the real world, then we start talking about effectiveness. So we use different terminology there. But I think that the take-home message for me is that all of these vaccines that we're using in North America, Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, and AstraZeneca, are all highly effective. In fact, more effective than we even really hoped for. They've exceeded our expectations in reducing disease, as well as now we're starting to get that data that they're also very effective at reducing onward transmission to others. I just want to caution people against sort of comparing the numbers directly, like comparing Pfizer to AstraZeneca, for example, because these vaccines were not studied head to head. And then these numbers actually exist with a range of, as you can see in the brackets. So I think the bottom line is I wouldn't encourage people to say, oh, I want Pfizer instead of AstraZeneca because of these numbers, because all of these vaccines are meeting the target, and that is they reduce symptomatic illness, they reduce hospitalization, they reduce death, and they also reduce onward transmission of the disease by an incredible amount.
And then, and I think part of what that graphic was showing is that they are pretty effective against the variants that we're seeing as well, right? Can you talk to us about that? Because people are very freaked out about the variants.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Sometimes I find in the COVID era, there's sort of, we're trying to answer questions before we have the information. So there's a lot of interest in, are the vaccines effective against the variants? And then some early information will come around antibody studies, where some scientists looked at, you know, whether or not kind of in the test tube environment, the antibodies induced by the vaccine were effective against the variants. But what we really want to know is what about in the real world? If I'm exposed to the variant originally found in India and I had Pfizer, am I protected, right? And so that data is coming in, but by far and away, it seems to be quite reassuring. And so we'll continue to keep an eye on that. And it's important to know that the best way to protect against variants and to prevent variants from occurring is to stop the virus from spreading. And vaccination is the strongest tool we have for that.
So, you know, we have this worldwide data on vaccines, and it's really quite poor. We have a couple of countries who have been very good at vaccinating, but we have many, many countries where there have either been no vaccines at all or a remarkably low level of vaccination. And this map shows in the dark green the countries that have had significant vaccination, fully vaccinated. Israel has about 59% of their population, Chile and the United States about 40%, Qatar, UK, Hungary about 30%. But we have many, many countries, most of Africa, much of Asia, that have very low levels of vaccination. So, Anne, you've lived in three continents. Can you talk to us about the importance of worldwide vaccination and worldwide interventions in a disease such as this?
So I read somewhere that, you know, the whole world depends on the entire world getting vaccinated. It is not going to be beneficial if the more well-off countries are, you know, take care of their population and they are make sure that their population is vaccinated, but the part of the world is not, because we are a global village. This disease started in one corner of the world, and within 24 hours, it's estimated that disease had spread to the other continents as well. We weren't aware of it at the time, but looking back, this disease and all future epidemics will travel in the same manner. So having lived in many different countries and experiencing the healthcare systems in many different countries, I can tell you that it is so variable. I trained in a medical school in India, which was a missionary medical school. So many of my colleagues continue to work in missionary hospitals in very remote parts of India. And they were telling me about, and they are telling me still, that there are a lot of patients over there who have COVID symptoms, are suffering from the disease and dying from it. But because a test is not available, they are not officially categorized as COVID deaths. This is problematic because this is an example of how undercounting is occurring all over the world. So if the numbers of COVID deaths are low in that area, then vaccination is not a priority in that area. This is a global problem that we need to address it. And I think the world needs to be united in trying to provide education, vaccination, and access to health all over the world if we are going to try to overcome this disease.
You know, Shabnam Paliwal, who I think is watching from India, asks, is this the peak or is it yet to come? The data we're seeing seems to be that the second wave is waning in India and in the East, but we will unfortunately see that shadow of deaths from this disease as we did in other parts of the world. Dr. Chandrasekhar, my mom and dad, have a question for you, Liz. In the New York Times, there was this article yesterday about dogs carrying COVID. And I remember about a year ago, there were all these articles about dogs and COVID and not kissing your dog. Can you talk to us about animals?
Sure. I'm unfortunately, I didn't see that article, so I can't comment on the dog piece. But I do know, like here in British Columbia, our big university, the University of British Columbia, is actually looking for patients who are recently diagnosed with COVID and have a cat to participate in their study. So it is something we're trying to understand more. And certainly coronaviruses are viruses that infect animals, and that's how, in fact, how we think that we bring these into the human population. So there's more to be understood there for sure. But I've seen various things about the dogs, and I remember at some point they joked that who let the dogs out? Like the WHO said, no, dogs are off the hook. So I guess it's an ongoing debate.
You know, there's my in-laws are vets, both of them, and they felt when they were looking early on at the dogs and the cats that the dog certainly is considered what they consider a dead-end host. Like the dog can have the virus, but he's not going to transmit it. And yet there was one about some discussion about a cat, but their feeling overall was that these are actually dead-end hosts and they can't transmit it to you if they get it. Can you give it to your animal? That, I don't know. You know, but I know that their feeling was that this was not going to, then the cat's not going to give it to your neighbor or certainly the dog. They were all on board for the dogs. So the dogs are off the hook.
Nice.
We have a question from Nancy Ross about allergies. If we're going to pop that question up. And so spring allergies, which she's had since childhood, all but disappeared this season. Could this be a wonderful side effect from the vaccines?
I think you covered this in a previous episode. I think it's probably the masks. I traveled to Japan a couple of years ago before COVID, and I was just so interested in that, you know, like 20% of the population was just wearing a mask on the subway. And I was trying to understand it. Obviously, there's this SARS round one history in Asia. But also there was all these other reasons that people wear masks. Like maybe they have some acne breakout, or like they didn't want to interact with people on the subway, or they had a cold, they didn't want to spread it. But also seasonal allergies, right? Protecting us from pollen. So I wonder if that's the case. And certainly my 10-year-old son also had a similar experience this year, although we're really not focused on outdoor masking at all in my neck of the woods.
You know, a lot of women have been commenting on social media that now that we get to take our masks off, will our male colleagues tell us to smile more? You know, so maybe we just don't want to smile anymore. Thank you everybody for watching from all around the world. We appreciate it. Please keep sending in your questions. We want to talk a little bit about long COVID or COVID long haulers, which has now been renamed PASC, which is post-acute sequelae of SARS-CoV-2, because why shouldn't we take an easy name and not make it hard? So Felicia, you have a lot of experience with long COVID. We talked about this back in August with Monica Gutierrez from the University of San Antonio. And, you know, it had just been recognized at that point. So we are several months later with a lot more knowledge. Maybe you can talk to us about why this happens, who gets it, and what do we do about it?
So the CDC, as you said, has decided to rename it and made it a little bit more difficult. But this is an ongoing problem that we are beginning to understand a little bit more about. I run a post-COVID clinic or a PASC clinic, and I see a wide variety of patients who are appearing with symptoms. Some of these patients had very minor illness. They did not require hospitalization. They had, you know, just a little fever, a little bit of shortness of breath, and about a week or two later, they start feeling better. But some of them, about a third of these patients don't make a full recovery. So at 2 months, they still continue to have symptoms. Some of the patients who were much iller, who were in the hospital, either intubated or had a prolonged stay, they are more commonly having these prolonged symptoms. Some of the most common symptoms I see is fatigue, both physically and cognitively. They describe it as a brain fog. Not all the patients can actually tell you what exactly is wrong, but I test them. And one of the things I find that they are having the most difficulty is paying attention. They can't stay focused, especially if they need to do in a typical day, we tend to multitask. We don't always realize it, but you know, you're looking at your computer, you might be talking to somebody else at the same time, and you know, your text goes off and you look at that, you take a quick glance, but you're still keeping track of everything. These patients cannot do this anymore. They can only do one thing at a time, and even that is not really that efficient. So complex attention is the thing that is most affected. The other thing is that they're very slow in processing information. So they feel like they're duh, you know, that they don't feel smart anymore. These are the two most common symptoms that they have cognitively. But what the patient usually says is that their memory is no good. Their memory is usually fairly intact. The thing is that they are not hearing what is being said. And once they hear it, they're not processing it quickly. So it feels like the memory is impaired. So that seems to be underreported. Not everybody is recognizing it. The other symptoms which are very common are shortness of breath, especially with exertion. So at rest, they may be fine. But we have them walk. We do like a 6-minute walk test where we are stressing them a little bit and they start to desaturate. They start to have symptoms. And the other thing is that they may have difficulty walking upstairs. That's another test that we do. The other symptoms, like loss of the sense of taste, it's more predominantly a loss of sense of smell. Patients don't always appreciate that, but they tell you their food doesn't taste very well. But on testing, the smell is affected far more than the taste. This seems to come back in a few months in most cases. There are a few patients who continue to have symptoms. The quality of life is another area that is most affected. Most patients feel like, you know, they feel anxious, they feel have a little depression. A surprising number of patients, even those with minor illnesses, have PTSD type syndrome. And we don't completely understand why this is happening, but it may be a result of the press and the news media daily reporting of the number of deaths. A lot of patients, once they know they have COVID, they are terrified. Some of them are afraid to go to sleep because they're not sure they're going to wake up again because of, you know, the constant reporting of patients who are fairly asymptomatic or had mild symptoms who then died. This is not common, but each case that is reported adds to sort of a global anxiety. And even after they recover, they seem to have that fear. It's not gone away.
And how long in the main, how long do patients suffer with these long haul? Like, I've seen some reports where people lose their sense of smell and it lasts much longer than their symptoms of COVID. But it seems like for the majority, they do regain some of that loss of smell. And there's some retraining that can be done as well.
Yes. Most people seem to be getting back. They don't never seem to be back to normal 100%, but about 2-3 months there, they can taste food again, but it's not the same intensity of taste and smell that they used to have. I think they will continue to improve, but it's probably going to take longer. And as with everything else, COVID, we don't really know the, you know, more definitive answers.
You know, from an ENT perspective, my colleagues in rhinology, because of course, ENT is just too much for one person. So I'm an E and I have friends who are an N and people who are a T. But so my nose friends are doing a lot of olfactory retraining. So really having 4 scents, like coffee and
coffee,
you know, and then, and really forcing them to retrain what's left of their olfactory nerves that were inflamed to bring that back. The other thing we're seeing is something I did with one of my T friends, Dr. Jonathan Aviv. There are people who are fine at rest, as you said, and they're actually okay when they're exerting, but they're on a Zoom call and they can't get through a paragraph. And they sort of, they lose their breath in the middle of talking. And they have normal lung images. Jonathan Aviv and Brian Tomashov, who's a pulmonary specialist at Columbia, and I found that in their inspiratory, expiratory curve, so they kind of go, right, and into a machine, and they can inspire well, but as they expire, they have a blunting of the curve, so they're not getting enough air out, so they, in fact, lose their voice. Though that seems to be a nerve inflammation at the vagus nerve, which is one of the nerves that comes from the brain that goes to your voice box, the vagus nerve. And that can be actually treated with a low-acid diet and voice retraining, which is very helpful.
We have a slide on that on your paper and also the way that the lung volume is blunted. Here it is.
Mm-hmm. And so, right. So as you expire, you can see the top of that sort of mountain curve. That's normal, but the bottom part is not normal. It's quite blunted because the vocal cords kind of slam shut as the vagus nerve tries to work. And then in the next graphic, you can see Dr. Aviv's dirty half dozen, which my son saw this and he said, is this a new type of drink? And I said, no, this is what you should not be consuming because these all have a pH of less than 4. And that soda, bottled iced tea, citrus, tomato sauce, not tomatoes, vinegar and wine. And by reducing these high acid foods and doing some voice retraining, we can actually help those people where their dyspnea or their trouble breathing comes from the vocal cords.
A lot of patients have the impact on their lungs as well. So breathing exercises definitely can help with this, improving the vital capacity. So you have more volume of air to start with for your conversation.
I think in India, there's a lot of emphasis on yogic breathing, pranayamic breathing in the early stages. And I want to get to some of your research in this area, Anne. But I would like to ask Liz, we had a question from a LinkedIn user. If somebody has a false negative RT-PCR report, but a positive antibody report, does it mean that there are enough antibodies to protect you? And when should you then plan your vaccination?
Okay, so
we're not going to give personal medical advice here.
Yeah.
Sort of global advice.
Yeah, what I would say is that I'm not aware of anything that if you had a negative or if somebody had a negative PCR but was found to have evidence of antibodies, I'm not aware of anything that suggests that person is less protected than anyone else who's been exposed to the virus. And then also we're not measuring T cells, and T cells are a really important part of the immune response too. We have these antibody proteins, but we also have these cells that help with immunity called T cells that are pretty smart. So the other thing I would say is how long to wait being vaccinated. You know, you can be vaccinated any time. That's our current guidance, at least where I live. Some people want to wait 3 months after they've had the illness. You're probably protected from natural infection for, you know, we'll see. We don't know yet, right? But it's many, many months, if not more. So yeah, I guess I would just say you can go anytime. Yeah.
Liz, we have some more questions though about treatments, right? What we started off the show saying, you know, February, March, we were learning from Italy and China, and, you know, then we all learned stuff and the rest of the country learns stuff from what happened to us in the tri-state area. And, there was all this discussion about hydroxychloroquine, you know, versus, and then steroids and other like antibiotics people were being put on. I can't remember which antibiotic was
azithromycin,
Z-Pax or whatever. So they were getting there was a run on Z-Packs. But now we're hearing some reports, and I think this came out in the Times recently as well, but there are other reports as well about patients who survive COVID then getting something called black lung and dying from that. So can we talk a little bit about what black lung is? And then we have a graphic on the treatments that you can get for COVID and what we shouldn't be doing with those potential treatments.
Okay, I just want to clarify with the black lung. Are you talking about mucormycosis or the black fungus? Yeah. So this is like a kind of fascinating being an ID specialist or infectious diseases. And now everybody's talking about this because of what's going on in India. This is a very rare disease. It's a fungal disease or a mold disease that can occur in the airways. So commonly in the upper sinuses or also in the lungs. And it's, so it's extremely rare, but it seems that there's a statistically interesting rate of this disease happening in India right now. And I don't think it's well understood yet. I think it's really important that people understand this is not a person-to-person transmitted fungus. This is just a fungus that's in the environment. And the risk factors are usually diabetes and then immunosuppressive therapies like steroids. So I think I would be sort of guessing, but there may be a higher proportion of people with undiagnosed or poorly controlled diabetes in India, where this is kind of unmasking that diagnosis. And there may also be a lot of steroid use. And in fact, we know that steroids help patients with COVID, but we only know that they help patients with more severe COVID who are requiring oxygen. And there may actually be harms to patients who are not sick enough to require oxygen. So more should be understood, but I think it's important people understand this is not a person-to-person transmitted fungus. So it's not going to spread person-to-person like COVID does.
Liz, if you look at that slide that we just put up, which shows what the guidance is now on medications, as I was saying early on, you know, and if we just zoom in on that slide, you can see that there's an X mark by hydroxychloroquine. There's, remdesivir, which was also being offered. That what they're really saying now is, and ivermectin was another one that early on was being, you know, touted and given to patients. But now, you know, there's, we can talk about antibodies, although it's not on this, but for the bottom of that slide, it talks about steroids, but you don't want to overuse steroids. And is that part of the reason, do you think, that some of these patients were getting this black fungus infection?
Yeah, it may be. I certainly don't know enough about what's going on. I'm just seeing what I'm reading, you know, what I'm reading. I understand that there's this urge to always do something, right? If we have a crisis on our hands, we want to do something. And if there's a treatment that helps the person that goes to hospital and requires oxygen, it's natural for us to want to get the benefits of that treatment too. But unfortunately, when we study treatments, what we learn is that they only benefit specific populations. And so we call that indications. So there may be a bit of an indication creep whereby patients are receiving steroids in the effort to do something. Maybe they're getting higher doses than were studied. I don't know. I think that's to be learned, but it is sort of a caution against, you know, if you're actually doing fine with your COVID and you're at home and you're not requiring oxygen, you're not going to get any benefit from steroids most likely. And there could be potential harms that we don't understand.
I think that's really important. People were jumping on all sorts of treatments months ago in the US, and we're seeing that in India. Speaking of India, we seem to have a lot of people tuning in from India, and we're wishing you all the best of health and return to full functionality in that beautiful country. Reshma Miriam, Chandan Nayak is thanking us for all this information. Srini Iyengar, who's an ophthalmologist in California, is saying, you know, talking about how terrible Mucor is. Ashok Kumar is watching. Jackie Kumar is watching from Bihar in India. And I think what I'd like to talk about is what you can do to maximize your recovery. I think, Anne, I was really impressed with what you had put together in terms of prehab almost, which is, you know, practicing your breathing and doing your exercises, perhaps when you're quarantined at home or you're worried that you've been exposed. And maybe you can talk to us a bit about the advice you're giving people to maximize their outcomes if they have confronted this disease.
So thanks, Jana. So I put this together very early on during the initial part of our pandemic when it struck New York. As with most other rehab departments in the tri-state areas, most of us closed down some of our units or downsized it. We closed all our outpatient rehabs practices as well, just because most of us were getting deployed to the active COVID floors. So our patients were really left with very little advice and information. So I put this together for my patients, but it quickly got, more people from other hospitals were asking for it. So I put it on the web. So this is a patient and a caregiver guide to managing an active COVID patient at home. So the advice is for both the patient and also for the caregiver. So I put in a lot of information about a diet and managing your stress levels, how to actually share a home with somebody who has COVID. The second part of it is the exercise part. Most of our patients who have COVID are extremely fatigued, and we are learning more and more about this disease, and we're finding that it is like some of these neuromuscular conditions where too much exercise is actually dangerous. COVID seems to fall into that sort of condition. So we have to actually very gently increase the exercise in this patient. So most of the patients, the exercises that we start with are the breathing exercises. Some of this will sound like exercises that you do in yoga, but we have a number of exercises to try and work the different parts of your respiratory system. And this is something we want everyone to do at all of the different levels. So I created three levels of exercises. The first level are for patients who are mostly bedbound. So these are exercises you just do lying down. You don't even have to sit up, because some of these patients have orthostatic hypotension. So that means if they sit up, their blood pressure drops and they start feeling very dizzy and woozy and feeling very ill, more ill. So these exercises in level one are just lying down. And the focus here is just breathing exercises, trying to get air into the different parts of your lung, trying to strengthen your diaphragm, which does about 80% of breathing. But when you're lying down in bed all the time, because your abdominal contents press against the diaphragm, it doesn't have the normal excursion that it has. The other exercises in level one are just to keep the range of motion in the joints, the shoulder and the hip. These are the joints that typically contract the earliest. So if you lie in bed, completely for 24 hours, you start losing muscle bulk and muscle strength. It's approximately about 1% of your muscle strength is lost for every full day you stay in bed. So a person with COVID who may have stayed in bed for 10 to 14 days is losing about 10 to 15% of their muscle strength. That's one of the reasons why they're so fatigued when they start getting up and trying to move around as well. In level two, I advanced the person into sitting exercises, and now we're trying to do range of motion in all the muscle joints, and we're trying to add some strengthening exercises. A level three is a person who can stand up independently and start walking, and now we go for a little bit more aerobic exercises. We've been using this in patients who are diagnosed with COVID. They come to the emergency room, we give them this booklet, they take it home. We also use it when they are being discharged. My hospital system and a few others are giving out the copies of these booklets to patients. I have had it translated now into six different languages. And a number of countries, rehab associations and general hospital groups are using it. So I think it's very useful. We have published it in a number of journals and different websites as well.
I'm really impressed that you've kept it open.
She's low-key saying that she, well, you know, it's been translated into 6 languages and different countries are using it. I think it's helpful. Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say that's really awesome. Congratulations. And I'm glad, you know, the seated exercises, when I'm sitting here, I always joke around that after my 2 kids, trying to get my lower abs to do anything is incredible. So always when I'm sitting, I try to do the little leg lift. So I was like, oh, look, she has seated exercises. I'm glad we didn't go to a 4 shot then, because I was peering at the screen trying to see what they were. We sadly are running out of time, and it would be wonderful just to hear some 3 takeaways for our viewers. Liz, we're going to start with you. Things that you think are, and you can do 5, whatever, but 3 is good too.
Sure. And I want to make sure our takeaways kind of reflect what we discussed. So I would say the first thing is that vaccines are awesome and vaccines are safe, and we should be having conversations with our families and friends and being completely non-judgmental if they have any concerns, so that they feel safe to talk to us about it. So that we can kind of move on from this COVID business and start getting more back to normal and protect people. I would also echo the sentiment we discussed around treatments. It's important that we don't cause harm in the efforts to do something. And we saw a lot of that kind of with the hydroxychloroquine chapter and so on, where we wanted to do something, but actually, you know, our immune systems are doing things too. So we can rely on them when we don't know what to do. And then we look to our studies to help us to understand what's actually going to help patients. I think actually that's all. I think I'm going to stick with 2.
So I agree with Liz totally, wholeheartedly. I think vaccines is so important. It's something that we all have to put our energy and efforts into, trying to get as many people vaccinated, encourage each other and your community, people who are resistant, you know, try to find out why they are resistant and try to respond to their anxieties. The other thing is exercise. I think we have a study going on right now where we're looking at your pre-morbid exercise habits to see how your outcomes are. And already the preliminary data is very highly suggestive that if you are the fitter you are before, the better your outcomes are. The disease is so much milder, and your recovery and the chance of getting post-COVID syndromes are also, we believe, are lower. My 3rd message is take care of yourself, your community, take care of the world. I think we all have to work together. We are not going to overcome this disease if we don't.
Those are great messages. And I think that hopefully our show has also been very focused on trying to get the message out about, you know, first, before we had the vaccine, hand washing, social distancing, masking. And now with the vaccine, it is so important to get vaccine hesitant people to think about, you know, the benefit, not to just themselves, but also to other people that might be compromised, et cetera, that are in their circles.
Yes. Thank you both so much. You know, it seems like we've been thinking and doing nothing but COVID for a year, and yet there's so much we learned today from Dr. Liz Parfit from British Columbia, who's an infectious disease specialist, and from Dr. Ann Felicia Ambrose, who is a physical medicine and rehab specialist at Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx in New York City. This disease is affecting urban, rural, suburban populations, and it is the world around. And we want to thank you both so very much for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
And thank you so much.
We want to thank our producers. Without them, we would not be able to get the show on the road as well. We are off next week for Memorial Day, but we'll be back Sunday, June 6th. And Sujana?
We are going to kick off Pride Month with two outstanding child psychiatry trainees. One is a fellow at University of California in San Francisco, Dr. Chase Anderson, and one is going to be an intern at Tufts University in Boston, Dr. Michael O'Brien. And we're going to talk about LGBTQ health, and we're going to talk about child and adolescent mental health. So happy Memorial Day to everyone. Stay safe and see you on June 6th.
Bye.